Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. 2 hours of open forum today, and you can start dialing now if you've got a question about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884. Anybody can call if there's something you'd like to know about the Bible, about Jesus, about the sacraments, about the Pope, about the moral teachings of the Church. 888-318-7884. And first hour, we have Jimmy Akin, and what we say when we have Jimmy on is you can also call and ask about anything else. Those are the two things, Catholic faith or anything else. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of a bunch of books, including The Bible is a Catholic Book, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of the most popular documentary podcasts out there on the earth. Jimmy Akin, welcome.
Thank you very much, Cy Kellett. Welcome.
And welcome right back to you. That's still true about the documentary podcast thing. You still are constantly in the when your episode comes out in the top 20 or top 10.
Yeah, it usually peaks around most weeks it peaks at number 8 the day after it comes out. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it gets up to 6 or 7.
Very good. So what will we be what should we expect tomorrow?
So tomorrow is the second part of a two-part look at modern reincarnation research. Last week, I described what modern reincarnation researchers have found, and this research is much more serious than what you would find in, like, pop culture accounts of reincarnation. You know, there are all kinds of accounts in pop culture of what are known as FPLs, famous past lives, where people claim to have been a king or a queen or a general or an artist or someone famous. And these are not taken very seriously in most cases by reincarnation researchers because there's no good evidence backing any of them up, hardly. There are maybe a few exceptions, but they're rare. But then modern reincarnation researchers have, because they don't focus on famous past lives, and they don't focus on hypnotic regression cases. You know, some people claim to be hypnotized and regressed into a past life. And and what they found is hypnosis is not a magic memory booster. Instead, it gives you permission to fantasize and confabulate. And so when they have studied cases where someone was hypnotically, quote unquote, regressed to a past life, nothing checks out that the person didn't already have some exposure to. But what they do most commonly is they'll look at cases of children who between the ages of 2 and 5 years old are spontaneously reporting memories that seem to come from a previous person's life. And they've studied these in quite a bit of detail. They have statistical patterns that have emerged in them. And so last week I described all that, and you know, here's the state of the research and what the data is. And this week I'm looking at the theories that could explain the data. Now, obviously, one of the theories is that reincarnation is actually happening, that people have a soul, and when they die, their soul passes into a new body. But that's just one theory. There are other theories. In fact, the theory I just described is kind of the Hindu theory, but there's also a Buddhist theory, which says there isn't a continuing soul that passes between people. They compare it in some of their literature to one candle lighting another. So it's like a flame may pass between two candles, but they're distinct candles. They're not the same candle. And then there are other theories as well that involve things like psychic functioning and also, of course, demons, because it's always demons. And so we're gonna take a look at the different theories that could explain the data. And I'm going to be proposing a theory that I have not seen in the literature. It appears to be a new theory that I think explains the data very well. And in fact, I think it explains the data better than other competing theories.
Check it out. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops every Friday morning. You can find it at mysterious.fm or just put in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and you'll find it. Lots of folks on the line. Two lines open right now. If you'd like to get in the queue to ask Jimmy a question, 888-318-7884. The number, Joseph is in New York. Joseph, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is regarding Matthew 18, when Jesus tells them they have the authority to bind and loose. I've seen different commentaries saying that this is only the apostles. And then when you have him saying, you know, where two or three are gathered, I'm in the midst of them. Some people say, well, that's just the typical Christian community. And then Paul says, you know, when the incestuous Corinthian, he tells the whole community that they have kind of the authority to, like, kick them out. So do these contradict each other, or is there one right interpretation of Matthew 18? Thank you.
Well, the different interpretations aren't all the same interpretation, so they contradict each other in that sense. But in terms of figuring out which one of them is most likely correct, I could say a few things. The first one is Matthew is an organizer. He takes material from different sources, and he likes to put it together in big discourses. You know, that's what the Sermon on the Mount is, for example. It's a collection of Jesus's ethical teachings, his moral teachings. And you can see that he's gathering them from different sources, because if you look, for example, in the Gospel of Luke, you find a lot of the same material, but it's scattered all over the place. And it looks like Matthew came along and collected a bunch of different ethical, moral sayings of Jesus and put them together in one big speech. And that's not the only discourse like that in Matthew. There are five of them, and they each have a different topic. And this chapter of Matthew, Matthew 18, happens to be one of those discourses. And the overall function of this discourse is to talk about relations within the church and how you're supposed to manage things in the church. There's actually a very interesting structure to the five different discourses in Matthew. The first one is Jesus's moral teachings, which corresponds to the law. And the last one, the Olivet Discourse, is a compilation of Jesus's prophetic teachings, which represents the prophets. So the two biggest ones at the beginning and the end represent the law and the prophets. You move in one step from that, to the second and the fourth discourses. The second discourse deals with evangelization, or the church's relationship to outsiders. And the fourth discourse deals with internal relations within the church, Christians' relationships to each other. And then the third discourse in the very middle is the kingdom parable. So it's the mystery of the kingdom of God. So you've got the law and the prophets, internal and external relations, and the mystery of God's kingdom smack dab in the middle. So, what we have in Matthew 18 is a collection of sayings that Jesus originally said in different contexts, and Matthew's put them together because they have a common theme, namely relations within the church. And scholars can even tell by looking at the beginnings of how these individual sayings are introduced, like, okay, here's a new saying, and so forth. And because of that, we can tell that the whatever you bind statement was originally a separate statement, and the wherever two or three of you gather, that was originally a separate statement. And that means that these statements occurred in a different context, and we're missing details that would have been clearer to the people who heard the original saying in its original context. So because we're lacking those details, the statements themselves are ambiguous. You could say, well, here in Matthew 18, he's talking to the disciples, to the apostles. So that's who this applies to. Well, that's one possible interpretation. You also could say, oh, this applies to all Christians. Or you could say it applies to something in the middle, something that's more than the 12 apostles, but less than all Christians. And we don't, in Matthew 18, have a clear way of separating that out and identifying one of those interpretations as correct above the others. But what we can do is appeal to other passages and say, okay, and our general knowledge of the views of Jesus and the apostles to get some clarity on this. I think an argument against this is just the apostles and it died with them view is that the church is going to have an ongoing need for leadership. And even if it was Jesus's will that the apostles pass from the scene, it wasn't his will that leadership pass from the scene in the church because he appointed leaders, and the apostles appointed other leaders to succeed them. On the other hand, what about the "this applies to every single Christian" view? Well, the power to bind and loose referred to the ability to make binding laws and or to release laws that were previously binding. That's just what the phrase meant in first century Judaism. So can any two Christians make a law that's binding for the entire Christian community? Well, that is not how laws work. You don't have just any two random members of a community being able to make laws that are binding for the entire community. If you did, chaos would result because everybody, I saw a parody a few years ago about a wiki constitution of the United States, where anybody, the constitution that anybody can edit. And all of a sudden, we've got all these mandatory firearms ownership requirement amendments and you know, and abortion restrictions and everything. It would be huge chaos if everybody could make binding law. So on the one hand, we need ongoing leadership in the church, which would suggest it's more than the apostles. But it can't be everybody gets to make the rules because that would be chaotic and nonsensical. Instead, given that this is a rulemaking function, the power to bind and loose, it would naturally be vested in the leaders of the community. And because that's how lawmaking works. The leaders get to make the laws. They need to be responsible. They need to take into account the needs of the people they're governing. But it's the leaders that get to make the laws, not every individual or two or three individuals. So it seems to me that the middle interpretation is most likely the correct one. One could debate that, but that's the way it seems to me.
And that is where we will have to leave it because we've got to take a quick break. Thank you very, very much for the call. Appreciate you getting us started, Joseph. Lots more folks on the line. So back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. Tonight, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. At least the ad does not have the word spiffy in it this time. Looking for the perfect book to explain the faith to non-Catholic friends and family? We've got just the ticket. Why We're Catholic. More than 400,000 copies in print and 6 years as the number one book in its category on Amazon. More than 1,600 five-star reviews. The book has helped a lot of people to understand what it is we believe as Catholics. And if you'd like to give that help to someone else or maybe get it for yourself, it's just $10 right now at shop.catholic.com. $10 for Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com. It's open forum today, second hour. We'll have Jim Blackburn here with us this hour, Jimmy Akin here, and you are welcome to call with whatever question you've got. 888-318-7884. Claire is in Cincinnati, Ohio. Claire, thank you for the call. Are you there with us?
Yes.
Hello, Claire. How old are you?
11.
And I think we might have spoken to you before, Claire. Have we spoken to you before?
Yes.
Well, it's nice to hear from you again. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Akin.
If Mary carried Jesus for a long time, she didn't get affected. Like when Moses went up to Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments, he came down with white hair. So why didn't Mary get affected?
I'm sorry, Claire. I missed part of what you said. You said Moses came down with what?
White hair.
He came, yeah. He got affected.
Right. No, I understand. I just needed clarification, Psychelet, on specifically what she said, because it sounded to me like she might have said white hands. Oh. And if that was the case, I would correct and say, no, he had, according to the text, a glowing face. It's not. It's also not white hair. It's his face was reported to glow. Oh. And so why didn't Mary have that happen? Well, this is a mystery. God doesn't tell us why it didn't happen. We can speculate. One reason is that Mary didn't see God face to face the way Moses did. And so her face would not have been affected. Another thing that's different is God presumably wanted the Israelites to see that Moses had been affected by his encounter with God. He wanted Moses to be a leader. He didn't want people to challenge Moses' authority. And so to communicate to the Israelites that I've met this man and he is my servant and you need to listen to him, he let Moses' face glow. But God didn't want that for Mary. He didn't want everybody to know that she was the mother of the Messiah, which could cause things like King Herod, for example, trying to find the child and kill him. It could cause other problems too. So he wanted Christ to be born in a situation where only a few people knew about him. And consequently, and when other people found out, like when Herod found out, they had to flee to Egypt for a period. And so he didn't want everybody knowing about Jesus. And so that could be one reason why he didn't have Mary affected in a special way that would make her look different from other pregnant women. On the other hand, she was affected by the pregnancy, including her physical appearance. You know, she would have grown large with Jesus towards the end of the pregnancy. And, you know, pregnant women, even though it's more of it's poetry rather than literally true, people often say pregnant women glow. And Mary may have glowed in that sense, but she didn't glow in the sense of having physical light radiating from her face the way Moses is reported to have.
Okay, Claire. Yeah. Oh, do we have Claire? Claire, that all makes sense to you?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Thank
you.
Well, thank you for the call. It's always nice when you call here. You do a very good job, and you're always welcome to call again. I hope we talk to you too soon.
Yeah. Kids generally do a very good job. They know what their question is, and they ask it. They don't feel the need to give the secret origin story of their question first.
I know, because they got a lot of questions. That's their habit, is just get to the question. What a nice call. What a very nice call. Charlie is in Wichita, Kansas. I don't know if he's a lineman. Listening on 96.7 FM. Charlie, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you for taking my question. Can you paint some color and clarity on the difference between the reverence that appears to differentiate between the American founding's perception between Catholicism and Protestantism? And I'll take my call offline.
Well, if I understand the question correctly, there are different attitudes somewhat different attitudes towards the founding of the United States in Protestant and Catholic circles in the United States. Now, if you go outside of the United States, you're going to find other Protestant views. Historically, most nations have not been democratic republics the way the United States is. Historically, most nations have been monarchies. And there was even skepticism about the American Revolution and our experiment in democracy in other countries in the past. And I'm sure there is some today as well, but especially in the past, you know, like, for example, in England, which we broke away from, the attitude was like, oh, those foolish Americans, this democracy thing is never going to work. Democracy never lasts. They need a king. People just need kings. And therefore, this is a foolish experiment and it's going to blow up in their faces. And one could even point to the Civil War as an example of it blowing up in our faces. But ultimately, the United States, survived, and we've been able to build a reputation. But if you go back and talk to Protestants in England at the time of the of the American Revolution, they would have had a rather negative view of it. Well, that's quite different than the view that the original reformers, the original revolutionaries had here in America. Because they were the ones doing the revoluting, they had a positive, you know, attitude towards what they were doing. You know, nobody looks in the mirror and sees a villain. So regardless of what side you're on, you're going to see your own actions as positive. And the revolutionaries viewed their own actions as positive. And of course, they won. So that has been passed down here in America, and lots of Americans have been very proud of what happened. You know, there are critics here within America too, but by and large, most Americans have a degree of pride and happiness and reverence for the founding fathers. Now, America also is a dominantly Protestant country historically. Now, these days, it's gotten up to, it's about a quarter Catholic, but historically in the past, it was like 95% plus Protestant. And so you had a lot of people who had been influenced by the rah, 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 go America, we're doing our bold experiment in democracy, and we're going to show the world. And our founding fathers were regarded as supremely wise men. And in fact, in many ways, they were. I mean, they came up with the concept of the separation of powers to and only gave certain functions to different branches of government so that no one branch of government could dominate, which had been one of the things that had caused previous democracies to become monarchies. If one person is able to get all the power, then you're going to have a monarchy again, whether you call it a monarchy or not. And so spreading the power around so not one branch does not have all the power, that was actually a very wise move. And so there, you know, Americans have been proud of that. Now, what about the Catholic community? Well, I think a lot of Catholics are just as influenced by American culture as Protestant Americans are, and they also look back on the founding fathers with comparable enthusiasm. I think there's a little bit of a difference in that Catholics tend to have, at least educated Catholics, tend to have a broader historical perspective. And one of the things that the Catholic tradition incorporates is a recognition that there's not just one acceptable form of government to God. God can work with monarchies. He can work with oligarchies, which is where you have more than one guy, but a select group of people who are in charge. And he can work with democracies. And God doesn't mandate a single form of government for everybody. So Catholics can look back on the founding of America by the founding fathers with pride and appreciation. But we wouldn't look at it as, oh, this is the only way it ever could have worked in accordance with God's will. And so we can be appreciative of it, but may not be quite as gung-ho about, oh, God, this was God's will that we do it exactly this way. And I think if they think about it, a lot of Protestant Americans would recognize, too, that it could have worked different ways than it did, and God didn't mandate exactly the way it happened, that this was an acceptable way in God's plan to govern a nation, but it wasn't the only possible one.
Charlie hung up because he said he was going to listen offline, and he did, I assume. Charlie, I hope that that answer was helpful to you, and thank you very much for the call. I'm going to go to San Antonio, Texas now. Daniel is watching on YouTube. Daniel, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, how's it going, guys? First of all, I want to say you guys make up my favorite tag team of a human and a cyborg.
Oh, and wait. Which one of us is the cyborg? Just so that I know. I think I have suspicion, but which one of us?
I think it goes without saying.
Okay, all right, fine. That's fine.
Jimmy.
Okay. Go ahead, Daniel.
Okay, Jimmy, so my question was, I was listening to your dialogue with William and Craig on Pints of Aquinas channel, and I did have one difficulty. It doesn't seem like a logical contradiction, but it would seem that an eternal universe would be independent from God, or at least have some sort of divine attribute. And I was wondering how that isn't problematic or like not a logical contradiction. I guess it wouldn't be a logical contradiction, but it would seem problematic to hold as a Christian.
Okay, so what would be problematic about it?
Oh, like I said, and maybe it just would seem like the universe at that point would be independent from God.
Not in Aquinas's view. So in Aquinas's view, if God chose to create a universe that has an eternal history, that would no more make the universe independent of God than if he chose to create a universe that has an infinite future, which he did, because we're always going to exist. There's a little more to say, and I'll say it on the other side of the break.
Daniel, thank you. If you can hang on, that would be great. We'll get you that answer, the rest of that answer, on the other side of the break. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, one line open, 888-318-7884. Excitement is building for Catholic Answers Annual Apologetics Conference, I Believe in God. There's still time to join us September 21st through 24th in sunny San Diego as we welcome Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers, as well as your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Join us for a conference that is sure to ignite, encourage, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Hi, this is Janet Williams. You don't have to be a woman to enjoy Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A little bit of groovy music there. That means it's Thursday. Almost always means Jimmy Akin is here, and both of those things are good. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884 and ask whatever question you've got on your mind. Daniel is in San Antonio, Texas, and was asking about how could an eternal universe be a creation of God. He said those two things don't seem to go together.
Well, he said that the universe would seem to be independent of God if it had an infinite past. But when considering any argument dealing with an infinite past, one of the first steps one should try is flipping the arrow of time and seeing if the argument still works. So instead of contemplating a universe with an infinite past, let's contemplate a universe that has an infinite future. And in fact, we live in such a universe. God created the universe. It has no end point. We're going to exist and reign with Christ forever. So we have an infinite future in front of us. But the mere fact that we have an infinite future in front of us doesn't make the universe independent of God, because it would not exist without God. So in his eternal now, God has created a universe with an infinite future. Time isn't passing for God. He's outside of time. He just went splat. There's a universe. It's got an infinite future. But that universe wouldn't exist if it wasn't for God's creative act in the eternal now. So now let's flip the arrow of time in the other direction. Well, God in his eternal now if he had chosen, could just go splat. There's a universe with an infinite history. And that universe would not exist if it wasn't for God creating it. And so as a result, that universe would not be independent of God. And similarly, if God in his eternal now chose to go splat, there's a universe with an infinite history and an infinite future. Well, once again, that universe would not exist if it wasn't for God's creative act. And therefore, the universe would not exist without God. And therefore, the universe is not independent of God. Does that help clarify things, Daniel, or is there another difficulty with this that you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, no, that really clears it up. You know, just pointing the arrow at the different direction helps me make sense of it.
Awesome.
All right, Daniel, thanks very, very much. I also like the use of the word splat to signify God's creative moment.
It is a spiffy word.
It's very spiffy. Now I see what you've done to me. Let's go to Andy in Phoenix, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Andy, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Hello. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. So this is a question I have. So I've been listening to a lot of Jimmy Akin, Joe Heschmeyer, and Trent Horn. And when one of Trent Horn's videos, he mentioned that to become, so it's like an introduction to becoming apologetic.
I'm sorry, John, I'm having trouble hearing you. Can you speak directly into the phone, please?
Can you hear me better now?
Much.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. People should never use speakerphone when they're going on the radio. Thank you.
Okay. What was the last thing you guys remember me saying?
You said you listened to me, Trent, and Joe.
Oh, yeah, okay. And then in one of Trent's videos, he mentioned about when becoming an apologetic, it's important to be specialized in a specific area, whether it be like you or Trent Horn defending the faith or something like bioethics. And the question I have is, what's a specific area in apologetics that really needs to like support and someone to be specialized in?
Well, I might have a somewhat different view in that I tend to be a generalist. I don't tend to focus in just one area of apologetics. Now, if I'm breaking into apologetics, then I might focus in a particular area that had work that needed to be done. And in fact, that's what I did. My training actually was in Christian apologetics generally. So I, you know, was a philosophy major. I was a grad student in philosophy, and I was specialized in arguments defending the Christian faith in general, including, for example, interacting with atheism. But when I came to work for Catholic Answers, I wasn't given the opportunity to do work interacting with atheism. At the time at Catholic Answers, the big focus was on doing Protestant Catholic apologetics. And that's something I also had a background in because I had converted from Protestantism to Catholicism. So I had a knowledge of that area and I used that. I actually, I've told Trent this, but I'm actually a little jealous that by the time he came around, Catholic Answers has expanded and he got the chance to interact with atheism, whereas I was not given that chance early on in my apologetics career. But, you know, careers develop over time. And so after I learned how to do, after I began implementing Protestant Catholic apologetics, I continued to study. I'm an autodidact, and so I'm constantly teaching myself something. And I began to study, for example, the Church Fathers and became knowledgeable about patristics. I began to study the liturgy and became knowledgeable about the liturgy. I began to study canon law and became knowledgeable about canon law. I continued to study the Bible and biblical background, so I continued to grow in that area. These days, I'm studying parapsychology, so I'm trying to pull in information from all different areas. I don't want to, as one of my career goals, I don't want to leave the field of apologetics the same as it was when I began. I don't want to just repeat the same arguments that other apologists are using. I want to bring new information into the field of apologetics, and I do so in a generalist way, moving from one area to another and trying to build a broad foundation that will allow me to interact with many different areas, you know, science, all kinds of different things. So if it's simply a question of finding an area to focus on as one breaks into apologetics, I would say it's really a matter of personal taste. There, one is unlikely to find a field where, as a beginner, one could make substantial contributions. When one is a beginner in any field, you're going to be learning the basics. And so I would say pick a basic area that interests you and begin working in that area of apologetics. And then over time, I'd say expand. Now, how much you expand is up to you. You may want to go super deep in some area, and that's fine. You may choose to go deep in multiple areas and become a generalist, which is what I've tried to do. I don't think there are a whole lot of areas that are essential to apologetics that aren't having some service. There are people who have a historical orientation who are doing apologetics work. There are people who have a scientific background who are doing apologetics work. There are moral theologians who are interacting with apologetics. So you have apologists in a lot of these different areas. I would say that there could be more people who are knowledgeable about science doing apologetics. And I would say in particular, there could be more people who are knowledgeable about parapsychology doing apologetics, because there's almost none of them these days. I'm the only one I'm aware of that is really doing that. But it's important to learn the basics first, and then one can branch out into other areas.
All right. That makes sense, Chandy.
Yeah, yeah. And then if you don't mind, another thing is that typically when I have like little discussions with either Protestants or agnostics, mm-hmm. I use a lot of logical reasoning to kind of Trent brought up the Socratic method, kind of mm-hmm. questioning them. But I also want to be able to kind of expand my knowledge in what is the using biblical references like you do, like you, Jimmy and Joe and and the Trent. You guys mm-hmm. Can pull a Bible verse out of the thin air, which is absolutely amazing to me. So I've been trying to listen to Bible in the Year podcast with on the Halo app, and that's been helping. But what else can I do to help with that?
Well, so I would say reading the Bible all the way through is good. That's a needed foundation. I would say also over time you will learn which verses are most relevant to apologetic discussions, because they're not all equally relevant. But there are certain verses that are, like Matthew 16:18. You know, that's very relevant to Protestant Catholic apologetics. It's the You Are Peter passage. And over time, just by interacting apologetically with people, you will learn those verses. You could, if you want, you know, you could make a study of a particular area of apologetics, like Protestant Catholic apologetics, and make a list of the verses that come up most often, both in Protestant arguments and in Catholic arguments. There's also another step, though, that you should take, and this is one that a lot of people tend to skip. You do need to read the entire Bible for general background, and you do need to look at individual passages that are relevant to the subjects you're going to be discussing, but you also need to do a middle step, which is learn how to read and interpret the Bible in its original context, not just in an apologetic discussion. If you're in an apologetic discussion and there's going to be a temptation to view a verse through an apologetic lens and say, oh, here's a verse that sounds kind of like what I want to prove, so let me grab it and use it. And that results in a kind of any stick will do style of apologetics, which leads to what's called proof texting in the negative sense of grabbing a verse as proof, even though it doesn't really prove what you want it to. So what needs to happen, and this is, I think this is true of apologists generally, what needs to happen is they need to get a broader foundation in terms of what's called exegesis, how to read and interpret Bible passages in their context, and not simply grab a verse because it sounds like it proves what I want, because frequently it's actually not proving that. when you're viewing verses through an apologetic lens, you know, it's like when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. When you're viewing Bible verses through an apologetic lens, every verse looks like it's proving what you want it to prove. But we need to check that tendency and step back and learn to read Scripture not through an apologetic lens, but through the lens that the original author intended. Because the original authors were not apologists. They were not writing for an apologetic audience. And so we need to learn to think, what did they mean by this? And then you can ask a secondary question of what lessons can I learn that are of apologetic value from the text? But I need to understand it on its own first.
Andy, thanks very, very much. You might get started on that is you could check out Carlo's podcast, Sunday Catholic Word. Just go to SundayCatholicWord.com, where he just takes the Sunday readings and looks at them the way an apologist might look at them. Thank you, Andy.
Actually, that's kind of the opposite of what I was recommending, which was looking at Scripture not as an apologist would, but as the original author and audience would, and only secondarily looking at it in terms of what would an apologist say.
Fair enough, but I do think that's what I don't know. Maybe you feel like Carlo doesn't do that, but it does seem to be that Carlo does. The connection wrongly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got you. Okay, fair enough. Andy, we got to take a break, however. Thank you very, very much for the call. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
It's You Choose Week on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie starting Monday.
This is a week-long celebration of topics suggested by you, the Take Two family.
Your submissions are always welcome at TakeTwoShow.com, and we will be spotlighting some of the great ideas you bring to the table on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie all next week, noon and midnight Eastern on EWTN Radio.
And it's your topics, so as a member of the Take Two family, you are the conversation.
You Choose Week on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It is open forum. You are welcome to call with your question because even if we don't get to it this hour, Jim Blackburn will be here with us second hour. And if you've got a question about the faith, you are welcome to call and ask at 888-318-7884. Going to go now to Nick in Minnesota watching on YouTube. Darren, I got logged out. Can you press number 6 for me? Nick, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. So I was just wondering, what would be your response to Father James Altman's video, Bergoglio is not the Pope? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I haven't watched the entire video yet, but I am aware of it. And I've watched part of it. And from, I would say, two things. The first is he's mistaken. All the evidence is that all the serious evidence, if you know how to process the evidence, all the evidence is that Jorge Bergoglio is the Pope. Pope Francis is the Pope. There is no serious doubt about that. And the people who argue to the contrary have various misunderstandings, which are sometimes quite profound. For example, there is a theory, and this is only a theory, this is not church teaching, but there was a theory that has been common historically among some theologians, not all theologians, but just some theologians have proposed a theory that if a pope formally taught heresy, he would cease to be pope. Well, number one, that's only a theory. That's not church teaching. That's just a theory, and there are other theories. But secondly, Pope Francis ain't taught heresy. And if you don't recognize that, then you either don't understand what Pope Francis has taught, or you don't understand what heresy is, or both. And so, so there is just no grounds for saying that Pope Francis is not Pope. He was Pope Benedict resigned. Pope Francis was elected. The College of Cardinals all swore loyalty to him, and there is no indication that there were any election irregularities that would undermine his election. Sometimes people say, "Oh, well, the St. Gallen Mafia was caucusing for votes." No, duh. That happens in every conclave, and that is not forbidden. If you read the Apostolic Constitution that governs conclaves, it does not forbid cardinals from saying, "Hey, who do we like? Who do we want to vote for? Let's see if we can get enough votes for our favorite candidate." That is not prohibited. People simply who make this argument simply have not read the document with sufficient care. They don't understand, if they bring in the idea of heresy, they don't understand the concept of heresy. And in watching the parts of Father Altman's video that I've watched so far, I was profoundly disappointed in the arguments that he used, because they were lousy. And he was regularly slurring over distinctions that are vitally important in the law. And so I would say it was a very unfortunate video. He used very unfortunate reasoning. And while I can't judge his heart, it was objectively sinful for him to make this video, because it is a scandalous video, meaning it will have a tendency to lead people into the sin of schism. And leading someone into the sin of schism is objectively sinful. So I can't judge his heart, but I thought it was a video that was ridiculous, ill-informed, and scandalous in the proper sense of the term, meaning having a tendency to lead people into sin.
Nick, I'm grateful for the question, and that seemed like a perfectly clear answer to me, so I hope that it was helpful to you. I am going to try to get more folks on, because we are getting near the end and every line is full. Deborah is in Canada watching on Facebook. Deborah, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello.
Hi, Deborah. You're on the air.
I'm a Catholic mother. My adult child is 38. Mm-hmm. And from a Catholic perspective and viewpoint, how much financial support do we provide for our adult children when they keep coming to us? I just don't know if it's becoming to be an unhealthy point, and it's playing with my health and my well-being. And yet, when I think of it, I think of Mary following Jesus to the cross, right to the very end, all the suffering she went through as a mother. I think of when they say, "Lay down your life for a friend." I just don't know how to reconcile this in my mind as to what I should do.
Well, Deborah, I want to give you the best answer I can. So the first thing I would say is, you are not Mary and your son is not Jesus. God had special missions for Mary and Jesus that entailed them doing things that ordinary people are not called to do. Ordinary men are not called to go die on a literal cross. Ordinary women are not called to witness their son die on a literal cross. So don't use what happened with Mary and Jesus as a standard for what you and your son need to do, because you are different people and you do not have the missions that God gave to Mary and Jesus. So don't use their actions and say, "I've got to live up to that exact same level." What your mission as a parent is to raise children to a successful adulthood. Now, they have free will, so you can't control what happens once they're an adult. But once they are an adult, you ordinarily, this would be the ordinary situation, is you ordinarily would not continue to give them financial aid. because they're an adult, unless they're disabled or something, they should be earning their own living at that stage of life. Now, can there be exceptions to that? Yes, of course. You know, we do continue to have ties of blood and family to adult children, and they can get into difficult situations where they need temporary help. Or they could even permanently, if they became disabled, they could need help permanently. And obviously, we don't want to just turn them out on the street. So there are situations in which it can be reasonable to help an adult child financially, but that needs to be on in a limited way on a temporary basis. The child should use what help you're giving them to get into a more stable situation where they're not having to repeatedly come to you for assistance. And if they are repeatedly coming to you for assistance, then you need to look at the situation and say, why is this? Why do they, is there really a need here? If there is a need, why is there this ongoing need? And is there something that can be done to correct it? And so there could be any number of reasons, and I don't know what they are in your situation, and unfortunately we don't have time to explore it more thoroughly, but I'll give just one example. Suppose that a child keeps coming to a parent for financial help because the child has a gambling problem. And when you give the child money, the child goes and gambles it and then needs to come back for more money. Well, if that's the reason for the child keeping coming back, if that's the reason the child keeps coming back, there's a grammatical construction that'll work. Then the obvious solution is address the gambling problem, and then the child won't need to come back. And you can tell the child, I'm sorry, but it's become clear that there's a problem here. I think you need to address this problem. You need to get some help. You know, there's counseling and stuff for people who have gambling problems, and you need to address that because that's feeding this situation. And if the child says, I'm not going to, then the loving thing for the parent to do would be to say, then I'm afraid I can't keep helping you, because I want to help you get to where you need to be. And where you need to be is financially independent, if assuming that's possible. And so I'm not going to subsidize a lifestyle that keeps you from getting to where you need to be. And I don't know that your child has a gambling problem, probably not, but there may be some problem or collection of problems that your child has that keep resulting in the child being back in this situation, and those problems need to be addressed. And so I would work lovingly with the child to try to identify, why does this keep happening? And if the child doesn't want to work with you in that process, or if the child says, I'm not going to take the advice to deal with this situation, I'm not going to change my behavior, then you would be reasonable as a parent to say, well, my goal is to try to help you get where you need to be. Where you need to be is financially independent, and I'm not going to subsidize a pattern of behavior that keeps you from getting to where you need to be. And I'm doing that out of love, because I'm not going to be around forever. You need to get to this point, and I want to help you get there. That's how I'm loving you. And so so that's kind of a general framework that I would propose that you consider in navigating these issues. I know it's very difficult to navigate these issues, but that's the general framework I would suggest to you.
Thank you very much. That was very helpful.
Oh, very good, Deborah.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for the call and for the question. And I'm looking at the phone lines, and there's still a bunch of folks on the line. So hang on. Jim Blackburn's going to be here with us for the second hour. One line open, soon to be two lines open, I think. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, this is your opportunity to ask, whether you're Catholic or not. 888-318-7884. Second part of Jimmy's two parts on reincarnation tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, thank you very much. Looking forward to seeing you here in California soon.
My pleasure. Not if I see you first. I mean,
oh, wow.
Looking forward to it too. See you next week.
See you next week, Jimmy. All right, right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.